Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we've been the TechNet, as we've done for lots of years. Main purpose of the TechNet is education. Amateur radio operators that have hands-on experience with the radio equipment gather at this time, the curious radio amateurs, and share that information with each other. TechNet is broken up into three sections. The first section, people sign in because they do have a question or a comment for the net. The second section is by Dr. Roy AC2GS, called Science Talk and Mailbag. The third section is by Paul, WS2N, who's going to be talking about some interesting space information tonight. And Roy's got an interesting puzzle tonight. Let me drop. The possibility exists that we'll have some interruptions tonight. The machine has been occasionally dropping out, but when it does drop out, it goes off the air for a few seconds and then comes back on. So we probably can continue with those dropouts. Maybe once every 5 minutes or so we'll have a dropout for 15 seconds. Numbers like that, maybe once every 10 minutes. It will happen, so don't give up the ghost because you hear that happen. Let me drop. One of the things that we've been forgetting to repeat is that people are sometimes intimidated by what they hear on the TechNet. They think the question they're going to ask is too simple. Don't worry about it. There's no such thing as a dumb question. Our philosophy is that when a person is asking a so-called dumb question, it really represents the biggest difference between what he knows and what he would like to know. Therefore, his question is most deserving of an answer. He needs the most amount of information, if you know what I mean. So don't worry about asking a dumb question. You won't get any flack on that one. Amateurradio.tangovictor. If you go to amateurradio.tangovictor, you'll see recordings of, I think, about 11 or 12 years worth of TechNet. Maybe it's even longer than that. The first 5 or 10 years were all indexed. Every 5 minutes, whatever the subject was indicated. That function, though, to index 4 hours of TechNet is a little bit too much to ask for. So the man who runs that KC2NJI, Mike Perry, can't expect him to keep doing that. Another interesting net is LimarTechNet.com, which has some additional information and graphs and pictures and whatever, reference to the TechNet. But the recordings, once again, are amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateur radio, and there's a double R there, end of amateur and beginning of radio. As you can tell, we've just had a dropout. So that's what one sounds like. And as you can tell, the machine just comes back on again afterwards. I guess is that maybe the final stage is overheating, and we think tomorrow the experts are going to go up to the repeater and correct that condition. Okay. If you do have a question or a comment, and you would like to sign in this time, you're going to give us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in would sound like this, AC2GS, Roy, and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
Kilo Charlie 2, Fox, Yankee, Yankee, KC2FYY, William, yes.
Perfect sign-in, William. Did it just right. Okay, FYY, William, we got him. Who's the next person who would like to sign in? Because you do have a question or a comment from the net.
November 2, Mike Oscar Charlie, Mike, and yes.
November 2, Mike Oscar Charlie, Mike. Okay, beautiful. Is there a third person to check in? Because you do have a question or a comment for the net. Call letters and name and the word yes right now. Go right ahead.
WS2N Paul with a yes. Good evening, Dick.
Okay, Paul. Haven't heard him sign in with a question for a long time. He's the man who gives us the space report. Normally, he's giving us information. He's going to be asking tonight. Okay, one last call. Anyone else to check in? Because you do have a question or a comment. And if things are kind of fast tonight, I was going to give you guys some technical information about what's really going on inside of an antenna. But maybe we won't have time for that, and we'll hold it off until next week. One more check. One more. Anyone else to sign in? Because you do have a question or a comment. Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay. We're going to go over to William first. KC2, Fox, Yankee, Yankee. Go right ahead, William. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick. I appreciate it. And if I need some more power, let me know. I'll just make a frequent drop so that if there's an issue, we can continue on. The question is regarding a modification to a duplexer. If you search the internet for Delta Bravo 4030, that's the duplexer I'm modifying. So it's a DB, a decibel product 4030, and there's a guy who's got a picture of it up online. You'll see N2 Charlie Kilo Hotel, N2CKH. If you click on that link, he says it's for sale.
I heard everything you're saying. When the machine drops out, it drops out on 85, but 975, 375 continues. So I can still hear what you're saying. So, okay, your 4030 Delta Bravo duplexer is what you're asking questions about. And go right ahead with the rest of your question now, William.
Okay, gotcha. So, originally it was factory made for 37 megahertz. So the plan is to move it up to a 6 meter pair. It's on 6 meters. So I opened up, there's four cavities. I opened up each of the cavities and I cut the helical coil in there and to the correct length. I put a T connector on it with a dummy load and a spectrum analyzer. And I was able to ensure that all of the cavities are correct. The interesting thing about the way this duplexer is configured is they have stubs associated with each cavity. It's a piece of coax. So on the high frequency side, they are open stubs. And on the low frequency side, they are closed stubs. I have the high frequency side working, but the low frequency side, I am unable to get the null exactly on frequency when I put the two cavities together. So I'm curious if there's any way I should approach the length of the stubs. On the low frequency side, they are shorted stubs, and the interconnect cable. So is there a specific like formula or approach of how I should solve this problem? KC2FY1.
Hey, let me ask a couple of questions. What you're trying to do, by the way, is a rather high technology tuning there, Bill. It's not easy to get a duplexer really working well when you're moving it that far from 37 megs up to 50 some odd megs for 6 meters. Did you change the length of the stubs proportional to wavelength, new wavelength versus old wavelength? Did you change the length of those stubs proportional to the wavelength? Over to you, William.
Negative. Now, tell me how I should do that and how I should test it. I was just referencing, I had cut some example ones based on a suggestion from an unidentified ham who had given some information in 1996 as a decibel product. But I need a scientific way to do that. How do you suggest?
When you measure the physical length of the stub, and if you really want to do it as a pure scientist, the stub, if it's air, no problem. If the stub has a dielectric in, if the stub has a dielectric inside, let's say polyethylene, which has a velocity factor of 66%, or Teflon, which is a 69 or 70%, and so on, when you include the velocity factor of the dielectric material that's in the stub and the physical length of the stub, you should be able to calculate how long the stub is in wavelength of the original frequency, 37 megacycles, I think it was. And now you're going to a higher frequency, so the stub is going to become shorter by the ratio of the 6 meter frequency to the 37. And so that new length, you want the stub to be the same wavelength in the new frequency as it was for the old frequency. So the stubs have to get shorter. And let's hope that finer tweaking of stub length is not required. But for the stub to give you the nulls in the right place, they have to be the right length and wavelength. So that's the first step of the retuning. And by the way, having the right instrumentation and doing a complete proper tuning of a duplexing filter when you're moving at that far in frequency, it's a fairly critical test you're about to do there, Bill. It's going to take an awful lot of tweaking. Not going to be an easy job, in my opinion. I hope I'm wrong. KC2FYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, KC2FYY. Well, interesting is that this did not come with any stuff, so I do not have an initial reference. In the documentation from years ago, it said that when the separation is more than 1 megahertz apart, that stubs aren't required. But I couldn't seem to get it working without the stubs. And would I say correctly, you can fill it in, the interconnect cable between the two cavities should be a quarter wave of the frequency.
Yeah, that's another tough one. The length of the jumpers between the cavities, are they a critical length for that particular design? There I don't know. I wish we had, KE2EJ, Eric. He's now a silent key, but he had done quite a bit of experimenting and tuning of duplexing filters. Andy, WA2CDL, has done some. He might be able to help. Trying to remember who else is a real filter maven. We need a real filter maven here. The quarter of a mix, the 600 kc of separation between transmit and receive frequency on 2 meters is so close that I think you're going to need the stubs in order to get the sharp notch. The 6 meter stub, the 37 meg duplexing filter. Do you happen to know what was the old separation between transmit and receive frequency on 30? Boy, it took a long time to come back that time. Okay, I think I heard you say, when I was listening to 375 and I was hearing you, William, that there was a 2 meg separation on the 37 meg duplexer. Boy, that's a nice wide separation percentage, making the duplexer a nice, easy design. And when you come down to only 600 kc, and on 6 meters, I think it's 600 kc is the separation, maybe it's even less, maybe it's 500. You're going to need those stubs, I'm pretty sure, in order to... By the way, you didn't mention whether or not the duplexer has got 4 cavities or 6 cavities total. 6 cavities would be an easier design to squeeze all of the separation required between transmit and receive, and isolation with only 4 cavities is a more difficult design. There's got to be a website that gives you a respected design of a duplexing filter. And when you find one of those which includes the stubs, and it gives you the dimensions and the information as to how to fabricate those stubs, that would help an awful lot. Back to you, William. KC2FYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, let me offer some clarification, because... First is it only has a total of 4 cavities, but on 6 meters, the standard split is 1 meg. So that's all I need to achieve is 1 meg. So it's not tighter than that. So hopefully that conveys the objective is make it for a 1 meg split. split. That's standard. So I might be able to get away without using the stub, which is a possibility, since I only need 1 meg on the split for that. But I will definitely investigate the duplexer filter tuning dimensions if I can find a site to do it. But maybe I should just try an interconnect cable without the stub and see what happens with that. Maybe that'll work since it's 1 meg apart. KC2FYY.
Beautiful. The 1 meg separation on 6 meters, that makes life a lot easier. And when it comes to the jumper cables, once again, if you calculate the wavelength of length of the jumper cables on 37 megacycles and make the jumpers the same length in wavelength on 6 meters, that's another recommendation. The length of those jumpers is part of the tuning. So to make them the right length in wavelength, you're going to be shortening them to make them the right length on 6 meters. My goodness, that dropout time is getting longer. It's becoming annoying. Okay, so you're going to experiment with the jumper's length. You're going to try it first without the stubs. There's a 50-50 chance you may be able to get sufficient tuning with 4 cavities, 1 meg separation on 6 meters without the stubs. 50-50 chance. But if you can find a design with the stubs, life will become easier. And if you fabricate and add those stubs, and some other modification of the cavity might be required in order to accommodate the stubs. But it's a real art form to make a good duplexing filter. You'd like to have something like 120 decibels of isolation between the transmit frequency and the receive frequency. In other words, a signal on the transmit frequency should be 120 dB weaker on the receiver channel of the duplexing filter. Anything less than that, you're going to probably get some desensitization of your 6-meter repeater, unless you've got super high dynamic range of that receiver, which is a rare thing. You're trying to keep the transmit signal getting into the receiver as weak as possible so as not to create desens. By desens, I mean, If you're doing a test where you inject the weakest possible signal into the antenna that the receiver will respond to with the transmitter turned off, and then while doing that test you turn on the transmitter, and if you now have to crank up the signal generator to find the threshold again, that number of dB you crank up, that's called desensitization. It's caused by that strong signal leaking through from the transmitter, creating receiver overload, which means the receiver is not as sensitive. It takes a stronger signal now. You'd like that to be a fraction of a dB if you can get it. In the worst case, it might be a 3, 5, 10 dB of desensitization when you turn on the transmitter. As you do these experiments and you do the research on this, there's other people who would like to know what you're finding out, William. So if you come back in future weeks and let us know how this duplexing filter tune-up is going, please come back and let us know. KC2FYY for any other comments, K2RIW.
Certainly, yes. I will come back when I get a solution, and I totally understand what you're saying with the isolation. 100%. Very good. Thanks again, Dick, and we'll talk to you again when we have a solution. K2RIW, KC2FYY.
Yeah, good luck with that project. It's a toughie, Bill. Okay, Mike was next. Into Mike Delta Charlie, I think it is, if I can read my writing correct. You got it, Mike. K2RIW. My name is Dick. We've been waiting for the repeater to come back. Okay, so those 10-meter repeaters you're having trouble getting into from your Freeport location, if I understand correctly, Mike. And are you sure you've got the right PL tone? Right PL tone and amplitude, because the 10-meter repeaters might be PL sensitive. And do you you probably believed you're putting in a reasonable amount of antenna power in order to wake up the repeater. So how sure are you that you've got the right amplitude of PL tone and the right PL tone frequency, Mike? N2 Mike Oscar Charlie, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I'm looking at the repeater guide, and I set the radio up, and I have the CTCSS tones that they give me for those particular repeaters, and I've followed it as best I'm able to, and I think that I'm doing everything right. My concern is that maybe with 100 watts, I'm not making it into the repeater itself, in which case it's just kind of a exercise in frustration. Though I do know that, you know, several years back on my 850, I was able to key up those repeaters, or at least one of the 10-meter repeaters, and I didn't know if maybe things have changed.
With a reasonable antenna installation and reasonable operation of the antenna at 100 watts, wow, you should be able to talk to repeaters almost 50 miles away, if you know what I mean. What's your guess as to the distance to that repeater? And is there any chance that there is a blockage? Although even if there was a blockage, you could get a pretty good indication. If you can hear the repeater output through your antenna, and 100 watts going into your antenna when you transmit, you definitely should be able to get back to it if you've got the right PL tone. So I presume you're able to hear these repeaters. Is that true? Back to you, Mike.
Yeah, I am able to hear at least one of them. And that's all I needed to know is, based on your experience, that 100 watts should be able to get it. So if I'm not, keying the repeater, there's obviously something else I'm doing. I just wanted to make sure that the repeaters actually were working and that it is not some known issue. I'll just keep plugging away on it. I just didn't want to spin my wheels, but I'd ask the experts who might have some insight. All right, that'll be fine for now there, Rick. Dick. So this is, K2RIW from M2MRC. Thank you.
Yeah, rarely does a repeater run more than 50 watts of output. And if you're hearing the repeater with reasonable signal-to-noise ratio, and you're running 100 watts going back, the insertion loss between the antennas in one direction and the other direction, in almost all cases, has to be identical. So if you're hearing that 50 watts, they should be hearing your 100 watts gangbusters. If you've got the right PL tone, they should hear your gangbusters with the 100 watts. So you've got the right power, you've got the right antenna, you've got the right insertion loss. The fact that you're hearing it means it's got to be able to hear you. So the only thing left is the right PL tone frequency and the right PL tone amplitude is the only thing I can think of after that. Unless the repeater happens to be an alligator. See, repeaters are sometimes called alligators or rabbits. A repeater that's got a dead receiver but a real big transmitter, they call that an alligator. A repeater that's got a real good hearing system but very weak transmitter, they call that a rabbit. So unless that repeater happens to be an alligator, and there's got to be a way you can talk to somebody who knows about that repeater to find out if it's got normal receiver sensitivity at the repeater. So good luck with that project. Please let us know what you find out with your future attempts and research on this one, Mike. Stand by.
Okay, very good, Dick. I appreciate the feedback, and I'll poke around there. Like I said, I didn't want to be spinning my wheels if there was some known issue, but it sounds like it's just a matter of my getting it right on my side. Okay, M2MOC is back to that.
Very fine, Mike. Okay, Paul is next, WS2N. Hey, Paul, we haven't heard you with a question for a long time, and I'll be hearing you on the input even if the machine drops out. You got it, Paul, K2RIW.
Very good, Nick. This is WS2N. Yeah, I just wanted to find out if anybody has had problems with regular wire ties, tie wraps for tying up cables outside, only outside, with the UV problem. It dawned on me recently. you know, every now and then I look down, I see another fire op laying on the ground, you know, from one of my antennas up there. You know, I'm just using regular white ones, sometimes black ones, but they weren't UV rated. So this weekend I went out and got the bright idea to fly UV rated ones. I wonder if anybody's ever been done that, notice that there's a difference. You know, after about 3-4 years, the one, you know, if it's not UV rated, I mean, they're coming off the, you know, they're flying out of the sky. I'm not operating duplex. I'm not sure if I'm still making it. Back to you, Jeff.
You're making it beautifully, Paul. Yes, non-UV rated Tyrants don't last more than a couple of years. I've had a few people who are doing rigging work on my tower, and they use the non-UV rated ones. We're back. All of the non-UV rated ones, within a couple of years, they fall off the tower, fly out of the sky, just like you said. So, tie wraps that are UV rated do a pretty good job. I still have more faith in black tape, but that's just me. A black tape, I think, is much more permanent. I've had black tape holding some of my cables on the tower for 20 years. Would a UV rated tie wrap last 20 years? I'm not sure. I've got very few tie wraps on my tower that are UV rated, and I don't think any of them have come off. But all of the ones non-UV rated, white and gray and red in color, they've all come off within a couple of years. So you're doing the right thing with the UV rated, but I'd be belt and suspenders. The tie wraps are good, but I would add black electrical tape on top of that. Not necessarily on top of the tie wrap, just in the same vicinity. Black electrical tape, properly done. And by the way, when you cut the end of the black electrical tape, do not pull it until it snaps. That part will unravel. Wrap as many turns of the black tape on the leg of the tower with the cable that you want, wrap the right number of turns, and then cut it with a knife or cut it with scissors. Don't stretch the end, because the stretch portion will slowly unravel. And properly done with black tape, a good brand of black electrical tape, vinyl, or the non-cloth type is the ones that I've used. Boy, that stuff lasts a long time. WS2N, K2RIW.
It's a question. I never heard anybody talk about it on the net, but the UV ones, if they're good, that's good to hear. I thought of it, so I started searching the internet, and nobody had it. Ace Hardware didn't have it. Nobody had it, except Home Depot. So I wound up there. They're like twice the price of the regular ones. So who cares? You know, like $8 for 100 of them. But, that's good to hear. And as far as the tape goes, I've always used black tape, like you said. But I went to Harbor Freight, four or five years ago, and I bought this. It was like 10 rolls of black tape. And boy, every one of them is junk. It's just garbage. It doesn't matter if you cut it with a scissor, utility knife, nothing. I mean, this stuff is coming off. I keep away from Harbor Freight for electrical tape. Back to you.
Bravo Zulu.
Go ahead, Bravo Zulu.
And, the best practices of using tape, like you said, Dick, is to wrap it tight.
Okay, we're back. What Bravo Zulu said was to, as you get to the end, lighten the wrap. In other words, don't stretch it as much for the last few turns, and then cut it with scissors. 3M makes a good brand of black electrical tape, and I guess the one sold by Home Depot, Paul was rather disappointed with them. I guess the glue sometimes turns into mush if it's cheaply made.
Home Depot, Harbor Freight.
Harbor Freight, okay, not Home Depot. Okay, but Yeah, Harbor Freight. Some of the stuff at Harbor Freight is very economic, and some of the stuff is a little bit too cheap, if you know what I mean. So, I wonder if Home Depot has got a better brand. And so, yeah, you had to pay extra dollars for the UV-rated tie wraps. And I guess you're saying none of the local stores had UV-rated ones. You had to buy them by mail order. Is that what you're saying, Paul? Over to you, Paul.
Yes, it was either mail order or, you know, or forget it. Yeah. The only one that I had was Home Depot. I didn't see it in Lowell's. And, yeah, I don't have that many. There are no more hardware stores left. Not here anyway. Electrical tape, I just use, you know, the old stuff that I have, but anything from that Harbor Freight was no good. Harbor Freight I like, don't get me wrong. There are a lot of tools and weird things I buy from Harbor Freight. But certain things, like you said, you got to watch. Back to you, Dick. Oh, by the way, wait. The difficult part about this was I had to go onto the roof and go near the chimney, and, you know, and a lot of these tie wraps broke off going to the TV antenna. You know, I've got the TV antenna up there for reception. And that was, 9 years ago, and every one of them are gone. That thing's been up for 9 years, and every one is gone. Yeah, how come?
Remember the bins on Cortland Street, huh?
Yeah, the bins on Cortland Street. Boy, do we miss them. Ever since the World Trade Center went up, all of Cortland Street disappeared. That was the good old days. The Harbor Freight black tape, you said it was terrible. What was it like? The glue was too mushy, or the backing was too skinny? What did you find wrong with the Harbor Freight black tape, Paul? Go ahead.
First of all, it's way too thin, whatever millimeter it is. It's super thin, and you can barely even get it off the roll. And when you do, it doesn't want to stay. It comes off. It, as far as being sticky, it's awful. I mean, yeah, you walk out with a couple of bucks, you get 10 rolls, but, you know, what good is it?
Yep, so we got to buy quality. Okay, we're back. We got to buy quality tie wraps and quality black electrical tape. We got to pay some money for it. I think you're saying Lowe's and Home Depot and all the other hardware stores didn't have UV-rated tie wraps. Is that true, Paul?
Home Depot did have them. They did have them. Lowell's didn't have it. Harbor Freight didn't have it. And Ace Hardware did not have it.
Oh, it's a supply house.
Bravo Zulu, you said a supply house has them? What supply house are you talking about, Bravo Zulu?
Well, out in Riverhead here, we have Schwang Electrical is the biggest. But any of the real, you know, where contractors go, where people who do this for a living, rather than, you know, the hobby shop type of places, including Lowe's and Home Depot. So Schwang Electric is the big one here, and they have the quality stuff. Of course, contractors, you know, it's not money is no object, but they can't afford to waste time dealing with lousy tape that they'll have to do the job 3 and 4 times over.
Okay, Sean's a good one to know, Rich. That's good information. Okay, this dropout is going to be a pain in the neck tonight. I hope it doesn't keep happening, but I know it is. Everybody, my guess is that the final stage overheats. And I think we have to even remove the input in order for the final stage to cool off. That's a guess on my part, because as we leave the machine completely quiet, it seems to come back on the air faster than if we were transmitting, waiting for it to restore. Glad to hear that they're back on the high-gain antenna, and we're not getting crackly, so I guess we don't have much wind tonight, or something has improved along those lines. Anyone else with any further questions or comments for the question and answer section of the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
52 Bravo Zulu, Rich.
Go right ahead, Rich.
I'm about to construct a 15-foot high antenna that will serve multiple purposes. 2 meters, 500 megahertz, 900, and maybe up to 1.2 or 1.5 gigahertz. And I have to do it as simple as possible. It's going to be length of PVC. And I was just wondering, I guess I have to make them all out of dipole, vertical or horizontal. What would the configuration be for each antenna from the top going down to, let's say, 6 feet or...
We heard everything you said there, Rich, even though the machine dropped out at the end. So you're going to use PVC to make this tower, and all of those bands you're going to have on there. And as long as each of the antennas are on different bands, vertically stacking the antennas, whether it be horizontal or vertically polarized, almost doesn't matter, but vertical stacking them vertically along that mast, you'll be amazed how close you can place antennas as long as they are on different frequencies. If they're on the same frequency and you're stacking two antennas, then there's specific spacing minimums that have got to be used. Otherwise, you don't get the benefit of using two versus one. The areas overlap. But a 6 meter antenna with a 2 meter antenna above it, with a 220 antenna above that, with a 450 antenna above that, with a 1296 antenna above that, they do not see each other. You can make those spacings 6 inches, a foot, foot and a half, you know, real close spacings, and you get no interference. So when it comes to putting a lot of antennas on a mast, that can save you a lot of mast space as long as you know that information. There are various people who have written articles saying that you have to calculate the effective area of each antenna and space them accordingly. Those effective areas do not count when they're on different bands. Your 6 meter antenna may have an effective area of 10 square feet, but with a 2 meter antenna alongside of it, the 6 meter antenna has almost zero area on the 2 meter frequency, almost zero effective capture area. So on 2 meters, the 6 meter antenna is transparent, and vice versa. Even because of the harmonic relationship between 2 meters and 450 frequencies, they still do not see each other. You may find that information unusual, not well rated by the articles you can read, but still, it can save you quite a bit of grief. Back to you, Rich. Whiskey 2, November 2, Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu. And so I gather from that, it doesn't matter at all which one is the first one on the top and second, third, fourth, fifth.
That's correct. You can stack them in any order you like. Because the foliage attenuation is usually worst on the higher frequency ones, you'd like them to be the highest. So people usually make it as a Christmas tree. A low frequency antenna down the bottom and a high frequency antenna up top. By the way, Rich, your audio could be at least 10 dB louder. That particular mic of yours seems to be rather weak, if you know what I mean. Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
Is anybody out there?
Yep, there are people out there. The repeater drops out periodically. The good news is it tends to come back on within 10, 20, 30 seconds, but every 3, 4, or 5 minutes, the repeater does drop out. Who's asking if anybody's out there? I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and this is the Technical Net.
Sorry, Dick. Transmitting on the wrong band. Anyway, and to SLS, yeah, I've been listening. I've been listening to the issues. Have a good night, and a happy new year to everybody. 7-3.
Yeah, Rich, W2 Bravo Zulu. You may have to shout into that microphone, or that particular rig, if it's one of these newer rigs that's using the FCC mandate on narrower frequencies, which is really not appropriate for ham radios. Maybe appropriate for the commercial bands, but... ham radio needs a full 5.5 kc of deviation, not 2 kc of deviation, if you know what I mean. That can make the audio very low. Anybody have any further questions or comments? Give me a call, letter, and name right now. KQRIW.
WX2N. Just wondering what size, diameter, mass is going to be. What, Rich is going to make that out of PVC. So.
Yeah, the good news is PVC comes in a lot of diameters. And the strength of PVC goes up either square law or cube law with diameter. You take the exact same wall thickness and make PVC tubing twice the diameter. You either get four times or eight times, I'm not sure which it is, more stiffness. So go to the widest diameter you can tolerate. Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
Now, Bravo Zulu, can you hear me at all, Dick?
Can I hear you at all? I heard you say that, but before that, I heard only every other word, and you were dropping out. And I don't think it's weakness of input. I guess when you modulate loud enough with that particular rig, for some reason it drops out. It's a guess on my part. Go ahead, Rich.
Three different SMAs. Oh, if that would help me. Just trying to say, if you can hear me, meter should be vertically polarized. Said it does.
Okay, I'm only hearing every other word, but you're asking vertical versus horizontal polarization. One of the things that I have done very frequently is set up my antennas at a 45-degree polarization. In other words, not horizontal, not vertical, halfway in between. You only lose a couple of dB from, but you now, with the slant polarization, you can now talk to the horizontal people and the vertical people. You can talk to the sideband people with the same antenna as the FM repeater people. You think that you're going to be cross-polarized to the repeater. By the time that signal bounces off all of the land and trees and buildings and water towers and everything else, it doesn't have pure polarization when it gets from your antenna to the repeater and vice versa. So polarization is nowhere near as sensitive as you think. If you try to set an antenna exactly at right angles so you get a polarization null, in most circumstances you'd be amazed how difficult it is to find that exact null polarization. It almost doesn't exist. Vertical polarization makes vertical stacking more difficult. So I would use either pure horizontal or slant 45-degree polarization is my recommendation. Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu. Try talking softer. Let's see if that stops the dropout. K2RIW.
Let's see, this will be the last question, so I don't have to torture you guys or myself. It's a different question, Dick, and it's a simple question, maybe a complicated answer. How exact does the aiming have to be, the bird, when you're trying to hit a satellite?
How precise does the aiming have to be when you're talking to a satellite? That's a function of what is the beam width of your antenna, depending on what antenna you're using. If you're using a dipole that's 80 degrees wide, you got a lot of leeway. If you're using a high-gain Yagi that's only 10 degrees wide, then you better be within plus or minus 5 degrees. So the beam width of the antenna that you are using determines what accuracy you need for the aiming of the antenna toward the satellite. Unless you happen to have a whole lot of excess power, and very rarely do people have excess power when they're talking to a satellite. That path to the satellite is very frequently downlink limited. I mean, the satellite is not running a kilowatt, and so the sensitivity of your receiver and the aiming of the antenna with the beam width, knowing the beam width of your antenna, usually it's kind of critical if you want to get good reception on the downlink from the satellite. Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu. By the way, when you're talking softer now, which I think you're doing, there was no dropout. For some crazy reason, when I told you to talk louder into the microphone, and every other word was a dropout when you did that. Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
In the past, you told me to back off. Okay, see, this new antenna will solve a lot of the problems, and I appreciate all the knowledge and wisdom going into this thing. If anybody has a last word on building a Home Depot PVC dipole antenna for five different frequencies, I can be emailed at w2bzradio@gmail.com. All right, thanks, guys. Back to Nick.
Bravo Zulu, are you going into the eastern input, the Selden input? Is that the input you're going into, Rich? Go ahead.
Yes, sure, sir. I'm going into...
you do drop out periodically. And you're going to be using dipoles on all these frequencies, is what I just heard you say. And are you sure the dipole is going to give you enough gain in the downlink? Do you have confirmation that someone else has used nothing but a dipole for the receiving antenna and got enough signal in the downlink from the from the satellite? Have you found an article where somebody said those words? Rich, go ahead.
No, but I asked you about 2 months ago, and you said that it might be okay. I know it's on the margins. I really do know it's on the margins. But I'm basically interested in, VHF and UHF rather than right now tackling, 1.5 gig for the Inmarsat satellite cluster. So right now I'm interested in VHF and UHF primarily. There is a new loop antenna. I'll quickly tell you about it if you can hear me okay.
Yeah, when I tune to 975, 375, I'm hearing you very well. When I tune to 85, your audio is quite low. That's a function of the coupling between the two machines. It's not your fault. But the audio is still low, but the audio is considerably louder when on 375. So go ahead and tell me about your loop antenna. And I presume you don't want to use higher gain antennas than dipoles because you don't want to go through the rigmarole of properly aiming them in azimuth and elevation. Okay, it's coming back. I noticed that when we don't transmit on either frequency, the repeater comes back on sooner. So apparently, when the final stage is being driven, it goes into its overload characteristics. When it comes to being stealthy and making sure that your PVC pipe is not very visible, you're probably thinking of small diameter to make it less visible. A much bigger factor is color. Consider counting... PVC pipe usually is bright white and really shows up. Consider painting it a dull brown. If you paint it a dull brown, you can go to a larger diameter and it'll be almost invisible to the average set of neighbors' eyes, if you know what I mean. So painting your tower can really make it less visible. Too bad they don't sell PVC in various colors, light brown. And now this loop antenna, I think you're, if I understand correctly, you're thinking of mounting the loop antenna below the other antennas. Is that what I heard you say, Rich, W2BZ, K2RIW?
That's what I, because, it's very sequential, so I'm thinking of, below, maybe a foot below the other antennas, is that a no-no, or is, am I...
I believe that's okay, where the loop is not very ground-sensitive, and it's not going to be very sensitive to the other antennas. A dipole mounted above a loop antenna, they are basically cross-polarized for the most part. The polarization is so different that they don't couple very much, in my opinion. But they are not absolutely sure. So how soon are you going to be putting this power up? And maybe you told us, but I didn't hear. How many feet of PVC pipe are you thinking of putting up, Rich? W2BZ, K2IW?
From Depot, other people can correct me. It's
It's an 8-foot piece or a 10-foot piece, and I'm thinking of a 1-inch diameter.
Yeah, 10 feet, 1-inch diameter, that's going to whip around quite a bit. I think you should go to a bigger diameter than 1-inch. I think you should use a bigger diameter. Stiffness and strength. Stiffness and strength goes up as a diameter squared. And painting it brown, I'd go to a larger diameter and paint it brown. Do you understand my philosophy on painting the CBC pipe, Rich? Go ahead.
Absolutely, and I'm actually
I'm waiting for it to come back. Boy, this is becoming annoying. Roy, I guess you were offering that we should give up tonight because of the dropout of the repeater, and maybe you were right. I didn't know it was going to be dropping out this drastically. Oh. Let's give it a try, Roy. AC2GS with the Science Talk, K2RIW. Good luck, Roy. K2RIW listening.
Okay, Dick, and I'm going to need a lot of luck. You don't realize, here in Glen Oakland, we missed about half of that conversation. I was able to pick it up off of the Echolink, but otherwise, people who weren't hooked into Echolink in addition, it was just silence for the last 4 minutes.
Yeah, that I'm aware of. I'm switching back and forth in my earphones to the receiver between A5 and Glen Oak and Eastern and Sullivan. So I knew that A5 wasn't there. Oh, well, let's hope A5. And A5, I am guessing the amplifier is overheating. If we remove the drive to it, so to speak, by not having an input, it seems to come back on the air faster, is my guess. And so, I guess there's ways you can find out. By Echolink, you can hear what's going on. Are you able to hear whether or not the output at 8.5 is there when you're transmitting into the system? Roy, go ahead.
Well, I've jury-rigged something. I can't hear it because I have too much latency on my radio. So the delay between repeating my radio transmission into my ear would just make me cuckoo. But I do have a waveform that shows me if I'm transmitting an audio signal. So I hopefully will be able to figure it out. The problem is going to be when I do the stories in which I'm reading the stories and not looking at the graph. So maybe we'll just try the puzzlers for tonight, see how that goes, and maybe do the stories next week.
That's a good suggestion, and that was a complete transmission. By way of Echolink, I wonder if you can get into Echolink and still be able to monitor whether or not an output on 8.5 exists. Over to you, Roy.
Well, it's just the same way. The problem is that there's even a greater latency issue with Echolink. So instead of something like 150 millisecond delay, it'll be a 250 millisecond delay.
Yeah, I know. That delay into your earphones can really goof you up without a whole lot of practice. With a whole lot of practice, I was able to live with that delay. By turning down the volume low enough into the earphones, I can tell that my voice is there. But as long as the volume is low enough, it doesn't set me into stuttering, if you know what I mean. So there are ways, and maybe you can see the waveform, maybe with an oscilloscope, you can find out the 8.5 output is displaying a waveform.
Okay, back on. I was wondering how I'm going to tell when it's going back on, but it makes enough crackles and noises that I can kind of figure it out. Let me attempt this and see what we can get. I already have clocked about 17 dropouts in the last hour, so this is going to be interesting. As always, I want to repeat to people that if you have any mailbag questions of a technical nature that you would like to ask Dick and you can't get onto the technical net, or if you have any space report questions or you like Paul to discuss a topic or read a website, or if you have any questions or topics for me or puzzlers, this week a gentleman actually gave me a puzzler, and I'm very thankful for that. So all those things you can send my way at my email address, which is mailbag at ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag at ac2gs.com. And anything that I mention tonight, hopefully, will have a link available on my link site, which is roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. Let me break for a second and give the repeater a little time to rest up, and then I will give you the puzzler.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou. Yes, Lou.
I stand by. Let it drop. All right. My suggestion is, if we have a thermal problem, is to let the transmitter drop completely between transmissions. In other words, don't just wait for the beep. Wait for the carry to go off. And maybe that'll keep it cool enough that it won't drop out on you unexpectedly.
Okay, Lou, it'll certainly stretch the time.
Yeah, rather awkward, but it may work. All right, NY Twitch.
Okay, awkward it is. A longtime TechNet listener, Rich N2XEO, offered me this little puzzler. You're sitting in a wooden chair in the middle of a room. There is no metal on your clothes or the chair or your body, and no place in that room. In one of your hands, you have, though, a bar magnet. Say it's 6 inches long by a half an inch wide. In the other hand, you have an identical piece of non-magnetized iron, identical in every way, but it couldn't lift the lightest iron paperclip in creation. It's not magnetized. So the question is, how can you tell which is the bar magnet and which is the piece of non-magnetized metal bar just by touching them only against each other? You can't go out and get yourself another piece of metal and see which one's magnetic. So anyone want to play this puzzler?
N1, YDY.
Yes, Hank.
My guess is that if you turn them perpendicular to each other, that you would be able to determine which one was the magnetized piece by which one had the greater strength when it attached to the other. In other words, if you had one 90 degrees to the other, the one with the greater pull would be the magnetized, narrower part rather than the longer, unmagnetized part.
Hank, you said at right angles. The critical part is that the tip of one must touch the middle of the other. A bar magnet has no magnetism in the middle of its length, so to speak. So, By touching one to the middle of the other and vice versa, you'll very rapidly find out which one is magnetized. Does that make sense, Hank?
Yeah, I knew what I was trying to say. I didn't get it out right, but that's what I was aiming at.
Okay, everyone's a wee bit too clever for this puzzler, so I have a second puzzler. I don't know if it's going to puzzle anyone. I don't know if it's going to annoy anyone, but it'll be interesting to give it a try. Let's see. A magnetic compass points to the Earth's magnetic poles, which are not exactly the same as the Earth's geographic poles. The question is, where on the surface of the Earth do you find the strongest north polarity magnetic field strength? I'll give you a plus or minus 500 miles. How's that?
This could be a trick question, Roy, because the Earth's north magnetic polarity might be at the South Pole, so that the north end of the needle on your compass in your hand points toward the magnetic north. Is that part of what is going on here? Is it the South Pole of the Earth that attracts the North Pole of the needle in my compass? Over to you, Roy.
where my reputation precedes me. So I'm kind of known at this point for tricky questions with tricky answers. So you've gamed the system, Dick. The problem.